This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, we feature a recent interview Terry did with journalist Pete Hamill. Hamill once fit the image of the hard-drinking journalist, hanging out in bars, letting off steam with the other reporters, and coaxing information out of neighborhood sources. But he hasn't had a drink in over 20 years. His recent memoir, A Drinking Life, is about the culture of drink he was once a part of and why he gave it up. Pete Hamill began his writing career in 1960 as a reporter for the New York Post. The paper's reputation was then based on its local reporting and liberal columnists. Hamill later became one of the paper's most popular columnists. The Post is now famous for its tabloid headlines and its changes of ownership. During one of those ownership changes, Hamill was hired, then fired, as editor-in-chief. But he kept putting the paper together anyway. Now he has no affiliation with the Post. Terry asked Pete Hamill if he thinks of himself as having helped create the myth of the hard-drinking journalist.
I don't think I created that myth, but I certainly inherited it. It was one of the things that I loved about the idea of the newspaper man in the abstract. I had seen all those newspaper man movies when I was a kid. The idea that you could hold your liquor and type a new lead on a breaking story was one of the things that you wore like a badge of honor. So I suppose during the period that I was drinking, I did help keep the myth going in my own way.
What kind of bars were good to hang out at when you were writing a story, and what could you get from being in a bar when you were looking for leads?
Well, the best bar to hang out in was one that had a typewriter on the premises. And I was not alone in having written stories actually in the basement of the Lion's Head. I think the best newspapermen bars were not inhabited only by newspapermen, but attracted politicians, hustlers of various kinds, actors, ball players. You know, a place that had an overlapping system of the categories that a newspaper is made up of. It wasn't just simply cops in the front of the paper, but it was the ball players in the back of the paper, the actors in the middle of the paper, and the politicians who, if they were not in handcuffs, were certainly at the bar trying to promote themselves into eternity.
But say you were investigating a murder in a Brooklyn neighborhood. Would you try to go to a bar in that neighborhood and hang out for a while, see what you could find out?
Well, almost always. That was the way we operated in those days, because New York at that time, and I'm talking the late 50s, early 60s, through the end of the 60s, really, when things began to change very quickly. New York at that time was a series of hamlets, connected hamlets. And the bar was still a major institution, along with the church and a political club and probably the police precinct. The bars were institutions in which people revealed themselves most nakedly often. So that if you were looking for information about someone in a story, somebody who had been shot and killed, or somebody whose kid had been shot and killed, or a family that had been burned out by a fire, whatever the nature of the story, a good neighborhood bar was probably the best source of information.
When you gave up drinking, could you still go to bars to talk to people about a story you were working on?
Well, I found out I could. I had a fear for a while, and one of the points of this book is that there is not just drinking, but a drinking life that you adhere to. And I thought for a long time that if I gave that up, I would change the nature of my own work. And it turned out, of course, that going to a bar sober, first of all, cuts down the time enormously. You become very aware of the repetition. You suddenly hear the same story told for the fifth time with very little illumination added along the way. But I did and still do go to bars and just shoot the breeze. They know that I don't drink, and those who are still among the living, we cherish our friendships to this day.
Pete Hamill is my guest. His new memoir is called A Drinking Life. How well did you write when you had been drinking?
Well, I never wrote while I was drinking. I had a couple of adventures with it early in my career where I tried to drink and then go into the office and do it, and I could not do it. My fingers would smash between the keys and nothing would come out. Drinking with newspaper men, and I think with a lot of other people too, is often done and most insidiously after work as a kind of reward. You figure, I've really worked at the top of my talent here as hard as I can. Now I'm entitled, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, in a way, the most debilitating part about it, because you continue to say to yourself, I'm not an alcoholic. That guy lying in the gutter with his shoes off, he's an alcoholic. But I work. I get up. I go to the office. I bring home a paycheck, and I feed my kids. But I think there's much more damage done to people's lives, to husbands and wives, to children, to talent, too, to those who work out of a base of talent, by the functioning drunk, the person who can get the work done. And I was very careful. I never drove. I didn't even have a driver's license until after I stopped drinking. And I never drank before I went to work. And that probably prolonged the life longer than I should have.
So you were the kind of drinker who could say, well, I drink, but I never miss a deadline.
Yeah, exactly. I think the most dangerous people, most dangerous myth about all of this is that that you have to hit bottom in order to start on your way up. And the people I knew who hit bottom never recovered. They were gone. They had wet brain, or they were dead. They succumbed to all kinds of things that were not directly alcohol related, not liver diseases, but they died of pneumonia. They died of bad habits, basically.
So you never bottomed out?
I never bottomed out in the sense that, in the classical sense. I mean, in this book, I wanted to make clear that I was not going to make this worse than it was. It was not about another lost weekend or days of wine and roses. In which you got the DTs and you're seeing Richard Nixon in the corner covered with ants. If that happened, it happened while I was awake. But I never got to that point. It's a book about getting to a certain point, realizing you're doing a lot of damage, even though you're having a lot of fun along the way, and pulling back and saying, I'm not going to live that life anymore. And it's the life that I'm talking about. You can't separate. With any kind of a problem you have, whether it's drugs or alcohol, you can't separate the dancer from the dance. You can't say, I'm going to solve this problem of alcohol as if it were a pothole disconnected from the rest of things. You have to examine the life that you're leading and the way you got into the habit and into what probably was the destructive part of that habit.
So you never joined AA, never joined support groups. Are you not a support group kind of person?
Not really. I don't dismiss them. I've seen them do enormous good among people that I know very closely. Very close friends of mine have been helped enormously by those groups. But 21 years ago, it wasn't quite as fashionable as it became 10 years ago to go into these 12-step programs. I think when the yuppie generation started getting jammed up with cocaine and other things, that this became a lot more plausible in a way. I come from a family of seven kids. I had a support group. My problem was not the isolation that comes with drinking or bad habits in general. It was dealing with myself. And as a writer, I had certain tools that took the place of that. I kept a journal, for example, after I stopped drinking, just really probing around with the best and toughest parts of my talent into myself for the first time. So that first year, I did a real rigorous examination of myself, the flaws, the holes, the responsibilities for things, not in any sort of masochistic way, but trying to be very clear-eyed and cold-hearted about it.
You're Irish. You grew up in an Irish neighborhood in Brooklyn. Do you think there's any truth in the stereotype of Irish culture as being a drinking culture?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that that Irish culture has been bound together for many centuries by drink. But it's not unique to Ireland. I think if you look at defeated nations, if you look at Poland, if you look at the American Indian, if you look at parts of Mexican life in the Southwest, people who have been defeated often are granted the luxury of destroying themselves by the conquerors. And I think Irish drinking came from the conquest of Ireland. It was not unique to the Irish at the time, but if you have no true power, you're granted certain powers by the occupiers most of the time. One of them is drinking. Another thing is machismo. I think machismo is more prevalent under among defeated people than it is among the winners. So that I think the Irish do share something with those other people that is unique to people having lost franchises. It's being able to confront that and say, will we let these people have a permanent victory? That leads to people saying, that's it, I'm not going to do them the favor of becoming a stage Irishman or a stage Pole or a stage Native American.
Right.
I'm going to live my life, not perform it, not according to their script, at least.
Your father was a drinker. Your father was from Ireland, moved to Brooklyn, where you were born. But he drank a lot when you were growing up. Did he ever give it up himself?
No, he never did. Near the end of his life, in the last 5 years of his life, he lived to be 80. In the last years of his life, particularly after his hair started getting gray, which was at the age of 75, God bless him, he had trouble with his heart, and they put a pacemaker in, and the doctor forbade him to either drink or smoke cigarettes. He went into the bleakest depression of his life. And I went to the doctor and said, look, I think the man would rather be dead than to continue to live like this. He is so depressed by all this. And he said, well, tell him he can have 2 drinks and 3 cigarettes. My father, being my father, expanded the franchise to 5 drinks and 8 cigarettes and lived fairly happily until the day he left us. So, no, he did not stop it. He kept drinking, but not at his age, and he had done probably a lot of physical damage. It didn't take much for him to get wrecked. I mean, a few drinks and he would be gone.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist and novelist Pete Hamill. His new memoir is called A Drinking Life. Why don't we take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more.
Sure.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Pete Hamill, the author of a new memoir called A Drinking Life. When you started at the Post in 1960, New York had 7 papers, which is just impossible to imagine now. Cities that have 2 papers are in really good shape nowadays. What was it like to have 7 papers?
It was an absolute feast, and even having the 7 papers, we were mourning the fact that we had already lost 2 or 3. We had lost the Brooklyn Eagle, which I used to deliver as a kid, which had a circulation of 300,000 and was just serving the borough of Brooklyn. That was gone. There was a paper called the Bronx Home News that was gone. I think the city was a better city because we had 7 newspapers. That meant there were 7 different teams of people keeping an eye on the politicians and watching what the cops did and feeding the general sense of debate in the city. For newspaper men, it was an enormous thing because if you didn't have a job, if you didn't like the job you had at the New York Journal American, you could go down the street and go to work for the Post. Somebody would always hire a good craftsman. So there was a kind of security in the work that is missing now for a lot of people. But more than anything else, it was that you had 7 distinct points of view on almost everything in the city that simply has not been replaced by television.
When you started working at the Post, do you think that the newspaper had a different place in its readers' lives than newspapers have in the lives of readers today?
Oh, I think I think lamentably that's true. Because television, although it was strong in 1960 and had been strong for most of a decade, television had not become the all-ruling version of information and entertainment that it's now become. the respect, almost worship of the printed word that came from the immigrants. For example, if you think that the Daily Forward, which is a Yiddish daily, once had a circulation of 250,000, and that its children were reading the New York Post, the children of those readers were reading the New York Post, you know that you were dealing with generations of people who knew that the words would set them free. They worshipped newspapers, columnists were the biggest stars in New York, not television people. Television people read news. It was an enormous, amazing period to be young and be alive in a city like New York.
It's funny, when you started at the Post in 1960, some people at the paper were afraid that the Post wouldn't live to see the end of the year. Of course, that's a tradition that's kept on. And last year, during the New York Post ownership wars, you were named editor-in-chief to save the paper. Then you were immediately fired by another publisher who bought the paper.
And then reinstated.
Yeah, now, after you were fired, though, you came in anyways to run the paper. Well, how did you make the decision to come in spite of the fact that you were fired?
It wasn't even a contest. You know, the guys that were running it as interim editors called me and said, "We got to have you here." And I said, "I'll be there." The reason was that the newspaper, that particular newspaper, had given me my life. If I had not been hired by Jimmy Wexler in the summer of 1960, I don't know what I'd be today. I have no idea. The paper gave me the way into the world that I had been searching desperately for as a kid since I was probably 8 or 9 years old, to go out into the world and embrace it and see it and ratify it and have it ratify me. And that newspaper, if there was anything physically or intellectually or emotionally that I could do to keep that newspaper alive, I was going to do it. If it meant standing in the doorway and fighting the cops, I was ready to do it.
So what did you have to do?
Well, we did it with, I think, enormous humor and a lot of style and a lot of fun and a sense of camaraderie. We just continued to put out the newspaper. It gave us enough time to begin the process of trying to find somebody who would buy the newspaper and keep it open. And we did that. It was finally Rupert Murdoch who came back through a series of legal and other moves to take over the paper again. And although there are some people not happy with what Murdoch has done, including some of the people who fought to keep it alive, it is alive. And I think if an institution is alive, it's capable of any number of transformations. This newspaper, I think, will be around in the 21st century.
How have you seen the role of the owner of a newspaper change over the years?
Well, I was lucky because Dorothy Schiff had a very personal involvement in running the Post when I was a kid. She would wander into the city room. She didn't know who the hell anybody was or what they did, but I think she did feel a very personal connection to that newspaper. And as a woman owner of a paper, she was very good at making certain that the staff had a whole lot of women on it, that people had opportunities, that blacks, for example, were given chances to work there. The first black reporter in a mainstream paper started at that newspaper. I think the growth of the large abstract corporation as owners of newspapers, although it provides a certain amount of security, I suppose, to those institutions, also separates the staff from a sense of embrace and loyalty and ownership based on talent, you know, where you could say, "This is my newspaper." When you said, "This is my newspaper," you didn't mean that you owned it. It meant that you had a piece of the franchise. You had paid some rent with the time of your life on that newspaper. I don't think that that's quite the same. I hope I'm wrong, because there's nothing quite like having that sense of walking out of school or coming out of whatever life you had into a newspaper and saying, "Man or woman, this is my newspaper. I hope that the younger people feel that, although the reports I get make me apprehensive about it.
You started off as a comic artist before you became a journalist. And you write about a couple of experiences when you were young, like you were sketching your girlfriend, and when she saw the sketch, she got really angry, and she thought, you must think I'm ugly, because she didn't like the way you looked, and the way she looked. And then you sketched somebody else, and they were really angry because they thought, do I look like that? Is my nose that big?
Right.
Did that teach you a lesson about what happens when you record your version of the truth?
Yes. In a word, yes. I mean, I learned what I later learned reading art history, why court painters were often put in the joint by the various kings for you know, Velazquez painting all the idiot children of the king of Spain probably was at the risk of his life. But I think it is a metaphor in an odd way for what you're trying to do. I think anybody, and I don't pretend to compare myself to artists, to great artists like that, but I think if you tell the truth, you're sometimes going to make people unhappy. But you have to be as ruthless with yourself as you are with them if you're going to be any good.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Terry Gross speaking with journalist Pete Hamill. His new memoir is called A Drinking Life. I'm Chris Spurgeon, and this is Fresh Air.